This is Talking Dementia with Remo Health. I'm your host, Dr. Emily Silverman. Join us as we explore the latest advancements, insights, and strategies that help empower those living with dementia and the families that support them. Each episode, we speak with leading experts, from physicians and researchers to policymakers and clinicians, to provide you with the resources needed to navigate this complex disease. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Meredith Bach. Dr. Bach is a board-certified neurologist and chief medical officer of Remo Health. She's dedicated her career to caring for individuals with neurodegenerative diseases and their families. Her clinical expertise is in cognitive and movement disorders, and her research at the University of California, San Francisco and the San Francisco VA has focused on earlier diagnosis of neurodegenerative disease, optimizing quality of life at each stage of illness, and the evaluation of interdisciplinary care models to manage complex symptoms. Welcome, Meredith.
Thanks, Emily. It's great to be here.
So, Meredith, tell me about your journey to neurology. How did you get interested in this field?
To begin with, I was exposed to the healthcare system at a pretty early age because my dad was diagnosed with cancer when I was 2 and died when I was 4. So, while I don't have a lot of memories from that time, I do have a lot of memories of how my mom and my family would talk about the care of his oncologists and what a huge difference it made for him and for all of us. And it really showed me how big of an impact doctors can have in people's lives to the degrees where the patient's families are still talking about it years later and how meaningful those interactions were. So I think those early experiences were a really important part of my journey into medicine in general. And then in terms of neurology, I think once I got to medical school, it really struck me that there's something unique and I think uniquely challenging about diseases that affect the brain. So I had a pretty memorable experience as a third-year medical student on my neurology core rotation, taking care of a young woman about my age who had a rare autoimmune disease leading to inflammation of her brain called NMDA encephalitis. She presented with behavioral changes, hallucinations, and seizures, and she ultimately responded really well to immunosuppressant therapy, and she gained back her motor function and her personality. And I was really struck by how deeply her disease was intertwined with her direct experience of the world around her and really her framework for interacting with the world. And being part of the team that helped her rebuild that was both, I think, really personally and intellectually compelling for me. It was just a really incredible experience. And I think it really just opened up for me that the brain, in my opinion, is really the last frontier of medicine. There's a lot of things we don't know, but we understand a lot about the heart. We understand a lot about the kidneys, and there are just still so many mysteries about the brain and so many diseases that urgently need to be understood better so that we can develop better treatments, because these diseases fundamentally affect the very core of who we are. So ultimately, when it came time to pick a specialty, I went with neurology. And, you know, other organs are cool, the kidneys are cool and all, but it's the brain. And I just knew it would never cease to amaze me and never be boring.
The last frontier comment really hits home. It's just such a mystery still. So you decided to go into neurology, you did a residency, and then became a faculty member and started getting involved with research in addition to your work with patients. Tell us about that chapter and what you loved about it, but also the parts of that chapter that left you wanting or longing or lacking.
I am a neurologist and I'm a researcher. I went into these fields because fundamentally, I want to improve the way we care for people with neurologic illness. And I feel extremely fortunate to have trained where I did train, where I was able to get incredible neurologic training about how to be a clinician and a really thoughtful provider for those patients. I love research. I love uncovering new knowledge, pushing the field forward. And so those aspects were really satisfying. And I think, like many of my contemporaries in medicine, I bumped up against some of the limitations of practicing in what is fundamentally a broken system in American healthcare. I think the type of patient that's not well served in the traditional healthcare system is exactly the kind of patient that I love to care for, which are older adults with complex chronic illness. And I think that there are two responses to finding yourself in that situation where you're trying to do your best for your patients in a system that feels broken. One is to get demoralized, and the other one is to try to find ways to more fundamentally change the system of care that you're working in. So I was drawn to Renamo because I felt that they are building something better for patients with dementia, which I feel as a frontline provider is desperately needed. And not only better care models, but also better support for caregivers, better data infrastructure for research, all the things that I think are really desperately needed for this patient population. And so when I heard about the mission at Remo and met the team who care about the same things I care about, I was excited and made the jump from the academic path.
I'm hearing what you're saying about the broken healthcare system and how patients who are older, patients with brain disease, complex disease, are the ones who slip through the cracks, and how Remo is really trying to redesign the experience from the clinical standpoint, from the patient standpoint. And we're going to get into that in a little bit. But there was something else you said about how there are certain types of research questions that you wanted to ask that you couldn't ask or couldn't get answers to in a traditional academic model. You know, there's only a certain type of data that's available, certain type of research that's accessible. Whereas when you pivot into a space like Remo, there's different data that you have access to that you don't in the ivory tower, so to speak. So can you speak to that? What is it on the research side that Remo offers that you weren't able to get at a place like UCSF?
I really see a place like Remo and a place like UCSF as being part of a broader research ecosystem where they have relative strengths. And so I think the strengths in academics and on the research side are projects that focus on the biomedical model of disease, things that require wet labs, translational science, and clinical trials are often really well suited to those environments. I think on the health services research side, you can certainly do that research in academic settings, and often it's a great place to do smaller proof of concept studies, but it's really hard to develop new care models and scale them within an environment that has fixed incentives and works in a certain way for a certain reason. And so in a place like Remo, you can try to align what you think is best for the patients with novel payment models like the new guide model, other systems that are in value-based care. And it really gives you the latitude to study and scale things that work to bring them to more patients. I see ourselves as really filling a missing link in the research ecosystem, which is between the smaller proof of concept study, which is extremely important for evidence generation, and the really large data set analysis, like all of Medicare data. I really see us as being the in-between between that, where how do we take the things we know work and bring them to more patients and families and evaluate them rigorously, but have much more detailed information on our patients than you would if you just looked at all of Medicare data, for example. So I think we are hopefully filling that missing link of taking things we know work and scaling them and evaluating them while still maintaining a high level of detail about each of our participants.
So let's see if I understood that properly. So let's say you're in an academic environment and you say to yourself, we're doing dementia care all wrong. You know, we're doing it this way, but we really need to do it that way. You can build a small team and develop a new way of giving care in a subset of a corner of a piece of a clinic or of the institution. Try it out, see how it goes, publish the data. But if the data shows that it works, taking that new way of delivering care and scaling it all the way across the institution or across multiple institutions or even around the nation, is really hard just because institutions are really rigid and change takes time and you can't revolutionize payment models overnight and staffing models overnight and even things like physical space and offices overnight. Whereas with something like Remo, where it's flexible, the rate of innovation is just way faster, way higher, that you can try things out. And if they go well, you can actually scale it up. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So tell us a bit about your role as a neurologist, because we're going to get into the Remo model of care and how that's different from the traditional model. In the Remo model, we talk a lot about the value of an interdisciplinary team, and probably the first member of the team that you think of is the doctor, right? You have a problem, a medical issue, a disease, you go to the doctor. So the doctor for a dementia patient usually is a neurologist. Sometimes people can't access a neurologist and they're working with their primary care doctor, but ideally you have a neurologist on the team. You're a neurologist. What is a neurologist? What should people living with dementia expect when they see their neurologist? What are the strengths of the neurologist? What are the things that they can do and that they do? But then also, what are some things that the neurologist doesn't do? And we can talk about other members of the team.
So my favorite way to describe what a neurologist does is the answer I gave to my 8-year-old niece when she asked me what I do, and I was trying to explain it to her. And so I said, a neurologist is a brain detective. There's something wrong with the brain, and we need to figure out what it is. And we need to gather clues along the way. So in this case, the clues are the history from the patient and the family, the physical exam, brain imaging, lab work. And we put together all the different clues to figure out where the problem is in the brain, firstly, and secondly, what's causing that problem. And so when we say we're diagnosticians, we're really brain detectives. There's a problem and we have to figure out where it is. And then after we figure out where the problem is and what's causing it, we can then provide counseling or treatment about the next steps. Sometimes the next steps are a medication. Other times it's getting a surgeon involved. Other times it's counseling about a diagnosis and what it means for the future. So it really just depends on the underlying nature of the problem. And for patients with dementia specifically, we're really trained to take a really in-depth history and do a really thorough exam to figure out whether changes in memory and thinking that someone is experiencing are dementia or if there's something else. And if it's something else, whether that can be treated. And if it is dementia, helping counsel about the type, what that means for the person, and then what to expect down the road.
And is it the sort of thing where a person or a family can walk into a neurologist's office, see them for an hour, and walk out with a diagnosis? Or does it sometimes take multiple visits?
That's a good question. It depends. Sometimes you can get a diagnosis in the first visit if all the information that's needed is available. Sometimes you walk in and see the neurologist and they might need something like a brain MRI or in-depth neuropsychological testing, which is a series of assessments that evaluate different kinds of memory and thinking to understand what the problems might be. Sometimes they need additional lab work to understand if a vitamin deficiency or a hormonal problem could be contributing to some of the memory problems, which would be treatable and not dementia. It would be cognitive issues for a different reason. So sometimes you can walk in and there's enough information available that a diagnosis can be made, but other times you see them and they might have a sense of what's going on, but there still need to be some additional tests done.
And sometimes additional tests are needed, but also time is needed, right? If it's early in the course of the disease, how often do you need to wait a little while to let the disease declare itself before you can know, okay, this is dementia type X?
That's a great point. Sometimes the additional factor needed is time. usually that's the case when I see someone really early in the disease process. So maybe they're having some mild cognitive symptoms, but it's not interfering too much with their life yet. In that case, they might have a condition called mild cognitive impairment, or even earlier than that, what we call subjective cognitive changes, which don't yet even register on a test like the neuropsychological test I mentioned. And in those cases, we do follow people over time and continue to evaluate them and see how they're doing and how the symptoms evolve. And that additional time and seeing what happens with the symptoms, what trajectory they're on, can ultimately give us the answer of what the diagnosis is.
So let's say you're a patient or a family and you receive a diagnosis. Your loved one has Alzheimer's. Your loved one has frontotemporal dementia. We know there's a lot of different types of dementias, different types of diagnoses. So then it sounds like the primary role of the neurologist is in the medical realm. It's things like vitamins, medications, what have you, counseling about what to expect. But there's a lot more to dementia care than the quote-unquote medical or the quote-unquote biological. Talk about some of the other members of the team. At Remo, we have very specific roles. Maybe you could walk us through some of those roles. What type of care provider is that person? And what is their role? What do they contribute to care?
Absolutely. Dementia is a neurologic diagnosis, but it really touches almost every aspect of life. And it affects a person's health, but also their financial situation, their legal situation. It has a lot of implications for their spiritual and existential well-being. So when someone starts to lose their cognitive abilities over time due to dementia, it starts to raise questions like, when do they need to stop managing their finances? When does a family member or friend need to become a decision maker on their behalf? What kind of help do they need to live safely in their home? If they do need extra help, how do you plan for that and pay for it? And when home is no longer a safe option, what are the other options and what do those look like and how do you navigate them? We learn a lot of stuff in medical school, but I'm the first to admit that we are not experts in those areas and most neurologists are not. So I think what happens in typical clinics now is people get the diagnosis and the counseling about the disease and maybe the underlying pathology, but a lot of these other questions go unanswered or they are really on their own navigating them. And so other members of the multidisciplinary team would be a care navigator, a social worker, a pharmacist, a nurse who can help address some of those many other questions that arise that are really outside of the scope of medical training.
So you mentioned some of these roles. We have the neurologist, of course, that's you or somebody like you. Care navigator, talk about that one, because in a way I see that as the quarterback of the team, somebody who has their eye on the field in all different places. What is a care navigator and what can families expect from a care navigator?
I completely agree. They're the quarterback of the team in a lot of ways. The first touch point, the person who gets to know the patient and their family over time. And what we have learned from prior research studies on interdisciplinary teams is that people really appreciate the extra support. And it can also be a little overwhelming to have a lot of different members on your care team, and knowing who to contact for what can be confusing and add to the overall overwhelm of interacting with the healthcare system. And so I think we've all had that experience where we're on a really long phone tree with a long wait time and we're just trying to reach someone in our clinic. And then maybe you're not even calling the right clinics, then you have to call a different clinic. And so just the experience of trying to access the right person in the healthcare system can be really frustrating. And that also goes for imaging and tests and other things like that. It can just be really frustrating for folks to have to schedule and manage all of that on their own. And we know that a lot of this burden falls to caregivers. And in addition to all of the really hard work that they're doing, taking care of their loved one at home or in a facility, to also have to do all of the care coordination can really be a lot. And so a care navigator is on the team to be a source of support for the caregiver and the patient, to help them get to the right people, to help direct their questions to the right resource, and to try to offload some of the burden of all that care coordination from the caregivers.
We also mentioned social worker, pharmacist, registered nurse. Can you say a few words about the other team members here at Remo?
The social worker is trained to do a lot of different tasks, connecting people to community-based resources, counseling on fulfilling advanced care plans and other legal documents. There's two different types of social workers. There's MSWs and LCSWs. Here at Remo, we have LCSWs, which means they're also licensed to provide counseling, which is an excellent additional resource. And then the pharmacist is really an expert in medications. And so we know that medications are a big potential safety issue in patients with dementia, firstly, because forgetting when to take your medications and how to take them safely can be a big problem. And also certain medications have a lot of side effects in people with dementia that I think are underrecognized more broadly in the community. And so the pharmacists are an additional resource to counsel people on safe medication practices and storage, get the right formulations for them, maybe packaging that's easier to take, easier to keep track of, and also counsel them on perhaps stopping certain medications that are worsening their cognition or following up really closely on medication changes. We just know that having a pharmacist proactively reach out to people with dementia and their caregivers on any medication changes or titrations that have been recommended by their doctor is really helpful to just prevent mistakes, prevent misunderstandings, and just keeping everyone safe and on the right medications at the right time.
And how about the registered nurse? Because when I imagine a nurse, usually I think of inside the hospital. If somebody's hospitalized, there's somebody there at the bedside tending to them and taking care of their comfort and their needs. I don't think as much about a nurse in the virtual setting or the outpatient setting. So what does that look like?
So the nurse at Remo is responsible for staffing the 24/7 advice line, which we feel really strongly is an essential resource for dyads. We know that dementia is a 24/7 issue. You don't stop having dementia overnight. There are issues that can come up at any time. And any person who cares for these patients regularly will tell you a lot of the potentially scary stuff can happen in the middle of the night, like wandering or confusion. And so we feel strongly that that 24/7 access to dementia specialists, like nurses with a lot of experience in dementia, is really important. And so they staff our 24/7 advice line so that when issues come up, people can call anytime to get advice, understand when it's appropriate to go to the ED, when it's appropriate to wait until the morning to talk to their neurologist, and just help talk through the situation that they're in.
So we have all these different team members. Each person has a different background, different training, different strengths, and they're working together. So are they talking to each other? Are they not talking to each other? What is it like to be a member of an interdisciplinary care team? And how is that different from, like you described, what is unfortunately the status quo, where you show up, you see a doctor, you get a diagnosis, and then kind of the rest of it just falls on you?
Yes, we are definitely talking to each other. That's a really, really important part of what we do, working closely together to care for the dyad. I also think that one of the huge benefits of working in an interdisciplinary team is for the patient and family to get additional support. I also selfishly think it's a much better experience of work for the providers, because these patients can be really complex and encounter different challenges that can require complex problem solving, and having lots of different people with different perspectives, with different training, all working together to solve these problems, not feeling like you're just alone in clinic trying to solve everything in the short amount of time you've been allotted, is a much better provider experience too, to feel like you have a whole team to bring to the table.
And how does a primary care doctor fit into all of this? There's the primary care doctor and the neurologist. Both of them are doctors. Are they talking to each other? Does the neurologist become the primary care doctor for patients with dementia? Or is it really more of a collaborative relationship where the primary care doctor is handling other medical issues and the neurologist is really focusing on the dementia aspect of the patient?
It's really more of a collaborative relationship. And it's really important to us at REMO to keep the primary care doctors involved very closely with what's happening. We work closely with primary doctors, especially on many of the conditions that are under their purview, like high blood pressure, that can certainly affect cognition and progression of dementia. So we work very closely with them, and ideally we're talking back and forth frequently. Those are the best situations where it's a true collaboration. And part of what our care navigator does is make sure that the primary doctor is aware of anything we recommended at REMO, making sure our notes get into their system, and just trying to take the burden off of the caregiver of conveying all that information back and forth between us.
And for the aspects of dementia care that are less medical, so to speak, you mentioned a couple of them: financial, legal. So working with the bank to figure out what settings should we have on this person's account, or should we add someone to the account? Also decisions about, is it time to prepare a will? Is it time to get things in order before you're not able to make those decisions any longer? How do those aspects of care get woven in? You mentioned the care navigator is somebody who can point people to resources, and the social worker, but just curious if you could speak to that a bit more.
Yeah, we definitely lean on our social worker, who has a lot of expertise in the right legal documents to fill out and when, and can also direct to more local resources, because the social worker often has expertise in several of the legal documents, but can also direct to resources of more in-depth legal and financial counseling that are often needed for really safeguarding finances.
I want to pivot to a passion area of yours, which is neuropalliative care and hospice medicine, which there's a little bit of overlap, but they're actually two different things. So maybe you can walk us through some definitions here. What is palliative care? What is neuropalliative care? And then what is hospice, and how are those similar or different?
I would love to talk about this. I think this is a great question because these terms are very commonly misunderstood. So palliative care is an interdisciplinary approach to care that has the goal of optimizing quality of life and decreasing suffering for people with serious complex illnesses. Neuropalliative care is the same exact thing, but just adapted for neurologic disorders, because that patient population has some unique palliative needs. And then hospice care is really a very specific type of palliative care, really a subset of it, that is really for people nearing the end of life. And the way the hospice benefit has been designed in the US, it's really people who are estimated to have a prognosis of 6 months or less who are eligible for that benefit. And so they're similar in that they're all interdisciplinary teams. They all take a more holistic approach to care. They really focus on quality of life. But they're different in that hospice is really focused on the end of life, and palliative care you can get in the outpatient setting. It could be started at any time with someone with a serious illness. And also, you don't have to stop any other therapies that you're doing to get outpatient palliative care. Whereas it is true that sometimes hospice requires some trade-offs where you might have to give up certain therapies to really get the full hospice care. That's not the case with palliative care. So you can get it at any time and it's additive to the other therapies you're receiving.
I love palliative care doctors and nurses. They just have such a wonderful touch at the bedside and often are so comforting and such great listeners. And I always feel relieved when somebody from palliative care comes into the room and there's almost like a deep breath that you take where it's like, somebody is here who is going to take a step back and look at this situation from more of a holistic view. And patients often feel that and love that too. But I have encountered some patients and families who feel a little bit defensive or standoffish about palliative care because there's this misconception that if you're involving a palliative care provider, that that means you're quote unquote giving up or you're not going to try to treat me anymore or something like that. And the palliative care folks talk a lot about this and how maybe they need some rebranding or some public education to help people understand that palliative care is not the same as giving up. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to that. Is that something that you've seen and that you've encountered? And how do you talk to patients and families about palliative care as being additive, like you said, and not requiring that you subtract anything from your care plan?
Palliative care definitely has a branding problem. Some palliative care clinics have renamed themselves supportive care clinics for this reason, to better describe what they're doing and get around the misconception. I have also had that experience where I think sometimes because palliative care is equated with hospice or equated with giving up certain other treatments, people feel like it could mean giving up. And what outpatient palliative care means is adding an interdisciplinary group of providers to your team that are focused on your quality of life and overall well-being. That means closer management of pain and other symptoms, really in-depth conversations about what to expect in the future and how to plan for it, more psychosocial support around coping with a complex illness, and really clarifying the person's goals and wishes so they can be honored at every stage of the disease. And when you describe it like that, people are like, great, I want that.
Sign me up.
Sign me up, yeah. But if you just say palliative care, it sometimes triggers this other reaction. So one piece of evidence that I like to cite for people is this really fascinating research paper that was published in the New England Journal in 2010 in patients with lung cancer, showing that early palliative care, in addition to all the standard cancer therapies they were getting, increased life expectancy compared to those who only received the standard cancer therapy. It was a randomized clinical trial, very high quality evidence. And this really surprised a lot of people because palliative care is focused on quality of life, and the explicit goal is not to extend length of life in the way that chemotherapy and radiation and other treatments like that are intended to do. But I guess it's not that surprising when you think about just adding this extra layer of support on top of everything else someone is getting can be beneficial for a lot of reasons, including survival. So I think that's a helpful example of palliative care is additive, and it doesn't mean giving up. It just means adding more support to what you're already getting.
And you can see how focusing on someone's goals might really change their care plan and make them feel heard and validated. And that emotional experience of, okay, we have a North Star here. Our goal is to take this last trip to Disney World with the kids, or our goal is this person really wants to go home to Mexico and die in their home country. Or even something simple like our goal is to watch the Super Bowl this year or something like that. Once you can orient toward what's really valuable or important to the person, it's almost like the mind, body, and spirit perk up. And you can see why someone might live longer if they're living toward something rather than just sort of a question mark. And it's like, do we do more? Do we do less? What do we do? I don't know if you've ever thought about it in those terms of there's almost a spiritual dimension to once you center the patient and what they want, maybe more of a motivation to live longer, if that makes sense.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think that's one of many benefits of having early and frequent conversations about the most important things to each person. And I do think there is a mysterious perking up that can happen. We probably can't explain it really in biomedical terms, but it's something both of us have seen just practicing medicine, where some of my patients who are really not doing well, they'll really perk up and look great in preparation for a grandchild's wedding or for the holidays or for something that's really important for them. And then maybe after that, they're ready for a different phase of care where they transition to focus on comfort. And so I've really seen firsthand how these goals and orienting to them can be hugely beneficial for folks. And it is one of those more mysterious things that I don't think we have any real biomedical explanation for.
The last frontier, as you said.
Yes, exactly.
It ain't a kidney.
It ain't a kidney.
So we've talked a lot about palliative care and how it's a holistic approach and how it's focused on talking to the patient, understanding their goals, understanding their values, and then driving the care toward those goals and those values. And I'm wondering if you could give me a couple examples, like maybe you can paint a picture of a hypothetical patient with a hypothetical type of dementia, and what might their care journey look like without palliative care, and what might their care journey look like with palliative care, almost like the randomized control trial that you mentioned. How might you compare an imagined different outcome for both of those cases?
Let's take a patient with dementia with Lewy bodies who is in a typical clinic. I think their trajectory would look like seeing their neurologist once every 6 months, having the dementia-specific medications like donepezil titrated, having close follow-up of their cognitive symptoms, really thorough evaluation of their cognitive symptoms, and having it be pretty circumscribed, pretty contained to those domains. I think someone with dementia with Lewy bodies going through a clinic that has a more interdisciplinary neuropalliative approach, they would be asked about their cognitive symptoms, but we know that patients with dementia with Lewy bodies also have a lot of mood symptoms like depression and anxiety, and they're much more likely to go deep on that. One great tip I learned from one of my palliative care colleagues is using a tool like a PHQ-2, which is a standardized assessment to distinguish between depression and the existential distress of adjusting to a serious illness. So knowing when someone needs therapy and when someone needs medication. So to really dig into the mood symptoms, understand what's causing them, understanding what specialized interventions could help, that kind of really in-depth symptom management beyond the cognitive issues is really one of their specialties. They also would have the time and the space and the priority to initiate conversations about goals for their care much earlier, which is a really essential part of dementia care, because as losing your cognitive and decision-making abilities is part of the disease, you really have to have these conversations very early in the disease course, and it's not always top of mind for memory specialists. And so palliative care physicians, because they have a lot of training on that, prioritize it early and really have a lot more training and communication skills for how to assist and support in those conversations. I think another benefit would be a really thoughtful consideration of when that person reaches hospice eligibility, because they have a lot more experience with that and when to transition care than most neurologists do. And so there's problems with referring too early to hospice or too late, not knowing the right time, especially for patients with dementia where prognosis is really uncertain. And I think the other benefit, which is related to that, is just having really frank and clear conversations about prognosis. I think that's one of the number one unmet needs that is articulated in current dementia care, is understanding what to expect in the future and even if there is uncertainty, how do you couch that uncertainty for people? How do you put parameters around it? How do you still paint a picture for them of what a best case, a worst case, a most likely scenario looks like? And I think palliative care doctors are very good at that. They often also have resources for more counseling. So I've been able to get counseling for caregivers through palliative care teams. And so just really drawing on the multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary benefits when you have a social worker or a counselor. They also often have chaplains, not always, but it's extremely helpful when they do to address some of the spiritual and existential distress around the diagnosis. And I found that to be a really helpful addition to the team as well.
Yeah, I love watching the palliative care team do their rounds in the hospital, because you'll often have a doctor, a nurse, a social worker, and a chaplain. And sometimes the chaplain will be wearing a little tag that says spiritual care. Yeah. And it just really draws the eye in a hospital, like spiritual care. It's just something that I think we could use so much more of.
They're so wise. I've learned so much from them over the years.
So you used cancer as an example earlier, talking about treatments like chemo and radiation, and there's just so many treatments out there for cancers, different types of cancers. And patients with cancer sometimes have a little bit more clarity about their trajectory, not always, but sometimes. Talk about dementia, because we don't have cures for dementia. We don't even really have that many treatments for dementia. And there's so many different types of dementia. Some of them go fast, some of them go very slow. What are the unique needs of dementia patients when you're thinking about palliative care compared to, say, a cancer population, which is a very different population?
I think the bulk of research on palliative care has been done in people with cancer. And many aspects of palliative care and even the training people get to become palliative care physicians are really tailored to that population. So in cancer, people usually retain their cognitive abilities until late in the illness, unless, of course, they have a cancer affecting the brain. There's usually a clear trade-off, a very clear line between disease-modifying therapies like chemotherapy and radiation and surgery, and not pursuing those therapies, in which case you explicitly change the goals to more comfort-focused therapy. And as you were saying before, often people with cancer and their physicians can have a fairly accurate idea of prognosis. Not always, but often there are more studies that can help us predict with higher accuracy how much time someone has and what their trajectory will look like. The more common symptoms in cancer are pain, difficulty breathing, symptoms that palliative care providers are usually very well trained to address. And dementia is fundamentally a different condition than cancer, and the palliative needs are really different. So dementia progresses slowly and much less predictably over years. Their palliative needs are much more spread out over time and start earlier in the disease course. And conversations about the future really need to start early, as early as possible, so that people with dementia can express everything that they want for the future, and those wishes can be honored even when they no longer are able to make decisions. And then the symptoms that they have are also much less commonly things like pain and shortness of breath, and much more commonly behavioral symptoms like agitation, psychosis, things that palliative medicine doctors have less training to address. And so there's really a huge need for more research on adapting palliative care to the unique needs of people with neurologic illness. There's now a newly formed International Neuropalliative Care Society. There's a lot of interest in this area because of the aging population and how prevalent dementia is becoming. And one aspect of palliative care that we've talked about is hospice, and that's really challenging in people with dementia to know when to refer them. The prognostic tools we have available are not good. They're not that helpful. We're just not that good at predicting what a trajectory will look like for someone with dementia. And so this really raises a lot of challenges about when to refer to hospice, when to refer to that level of care. And in my experience too, the hospice benefit is sometimes used as a stopgap because it's so hard to get other in-home services paid for through Medicare or other insurance. And so sometimes people in geographic areas that don't have a lot of alternative options will at least get some in-home support through hospice, even if it's not exactly the perfect fit for their needs. And then they get disenrolled from hospice, and it leads to a lot of really burdensome transitions of care and confusion with everyone about the goals and who's really driving the ship. And so I think some of the issues with palliative care and hospice care and dementia have really highlighted the need to have different types of care models that really provide more interdisciplinary holistic support earlier and throughout the disease, instead of having one disease modifying model and then a quick transition to comfort focused care. There's really a much blurrier and longer transition for people with dementia.
That example you just gave is really notable. Like, we need some help in the house. I guess we'll enroll in hospice to get some help. But then 2-3 years later, the patient's still alive. As you said, in the US, hospice is really designed for people who are expected to live 6 months or less. So what happens? Do they get a letter that says, you lived too long, so we're kicking you out of hospice? That's just so confusing. Can you talk a little bit more about how that might work? And have you seen this happen?
Yeah, this is a real area of interest for me because I've seen it be a big problem for my patients. And I'm actually working with a really amazing researcher named Lauren Hunt, who's a former hospice nurse who is looking exactly at this question and using Medicare data to look at what happens to these people who get disenrolled from hospice and who is it and what are the factors that predict this. It's a different experience depending on the hospice. So I had one patient living in a geographic area where there just weren't a lot of options for in-home care. And actually, his primary care doctor referred him to hospice. And I was shocked when I got the news. I thought I must have missed something really big that had happened to him, because I had been caring for him for years and he had Parkinson's disease dementia and was slowly progressive. But there was nothing acutely that had happened that made me think that he was now in this category that had a prognosis of 6 months or less. And when I spoke to him, it turned out it was really just out of a desire to get him more support at home. And in this case, they were able to continue most of his medications. And then he voluntarily disenrolled himself from hospice and just came back to his normal care. But it really caused a lot of confusion within the healthcare team. And I wasn't sure if I was supposed to keep seeing him. And there was just a lot of back and forth with the primary care doctor. And then when he got discharged from hospice, we had to redo all his medications because they had all been modified by the hospice team based on what they were seeing in person. But it's really different than if you're trying to promote someone's mobility outside the home. And so I think just the timing of referral was off, and it was well-intentioned. They were just trying to get him more support. And it's just really hard when there aren't alternatives, but it can lead to some inappropriate hospice referrals. And then sometimes folks get meds from the comfort kit that we wouldn't normally recommend to them that might cause a lot of confusion. And then all their medications get modified without the involvement of their outpatient doctors. And then when they come back out, you kind of have to reset. And then I think it's really confusing for families too, to have these shifting goals of care and being cared for in different care environments, like outpatient clinics versus hospice. So the whole thing, I think, is just really confusing for both the patients and the healthcare team when people are coming in and out of hospice.
I've heard that there's a great story about you around 5 years ago writing down your personal mission in a personal journal that you kept about the vision that you had for patients, palliative care, dementia. Can you bring us into that moment? Where were you and what inspired you to put pen to paper, and what did you write, and do you still have it?
That's so funny. Yes, I do still have it. Yeah, I think what inspired that was, I think I was at a moment in my career where I was really wondering, what does physicianhood mean to me? And so I wrote this mission statement for my career, which was really the purpose of it is to improve the quality of life for people with neurodegenerative illness and their families. And that I wanted everything that I do to align with that North Star.
And so here you are 5 years later.
Yeah.
Your journal with your mission statement probably tucked away somewhere. And you're now the CMO of REMO. What do you hope to see for patients with dementia and their families moving forward? Do you have optimism? Do you have a vision? Tell us what the future holds in an ideal world.
I am really optimistic about better treatments, true disease-modifying curative treatments coming down the pipeline. I think it's complicated, and I think it's not going to be a trivial feat, but I'm really optimistic about getting there and having better treatments available for people with this condition. I also think that while we await that, there's so much we can do for people now. And what I'm really optimistic about is providing all the things that we know work now to people who need it now. And that's really what makes me so optimistic about REMO is pulling together all of the support, time, resources, education that can help people with dementia and their families right away without having to wait years and years for a treatment to come down the pipeline to improve their quality of life, to improve their experience of their disease, to honor them, honor their personhood, their dignity. I'm really excited about that.
I think that's a great place to end. I've learned so much from this conversation, from your expertise. I can really feel your passion for this topic, and it's so inspiring. And the patients at REMO are very lucky to have you in their corner fighting for them. And just wanted to say thank you for coming on today and talking to us about your journey and about your vision.
Thanks, Emily. Life goal checked to be interviewed by you, so I appreciate it.
I have been speaking to Dr. Meredith Bock, neurologist and chief medical officer of REMO. Meredith, thanks so much again.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening. For more information about this episode, check out the links and resources listed in the show notes. If you're interested in learning more from REMO, visit us at www.remo.health. Take care.